Hey, welcome back to the Shift Extension podcast. So I'm Nick, and I'm joined once again by the one, the only, the Sunny Whitfield. This is episode two of our second season, or our episodes for 2023. And we've got another case study today. We're going to talk about some ideas and see if we can impart some ways in which you can become a better clinician. Sonny, how are you?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Awesome. Awesome.
I'm looking forward to today, though. Hey, we're going to talk about one of those crackers, cardiac arrest.
Cardiac arrest. When was the last cardiac arrest you went to?
It was actually quite recently.
Okay.
But it was in public, so I wasn't on the job and I wasn't in uniform. So it was just BLS all the way and encourage people to get on the chest.
So you were off duty?
I was off duty.
Oh, wow.
I think I was trying to get milk and bread at the time.
What was your reaction when you saw a cardiac arrest on your day off?
Honestly?
Give me your honest. Yeah, go on.
I was fairly disappointed. It's a different kind of reaction to how I was 10
it's
years ago on the job.
It's my one day off.
To go to one. Yeah.
Well, Sunny 10 years ago. So Sunny and I started training together in Bundaberg back in 2010?
Yeah, those 2011? Who are unaware, that's the east coast of Australia and up north.
Yeah, we're both bug-eyed. Very green, staring at each other in a loving way in a training room in the back of the station with another of having no idea what we're doing. And to this day, we still have no idea what we're doing.
But we're getting there.
We'll figure it out.
We will. We're figuring it out as we go. We're helping others figure it out as we go along. And why not talk about cardiac arrest?
Let's do it. So do you want to introduce the topic or shall I?
Look, I mean, I can throw my own two cents in. I heard a really, really interesting conversation in a different workplace the other day.
Mm.
Some of the work I do is in a non-clinical workplace because I do a lot of medical standbys on film sets and things like that on days off.
Mm.
But there was a discussion around cardiac arrest and what people should and shouldn't do, and it was really interesting for me to sit kind of as a fly on the wall and listen to people debate what they absolutely knew that they knew about cardiac arrest from the public's perspective. And I can tell you that if it was a shade of blue, it went all the way from white to dark blue in terms of what people thought you should do to manage a cardiac arrest well. And it did make me wonder if we had the same conversation with paramedics, how different that would be, because there's a lot of different jurisdictional services implementing a lot of different things. But the one thing that doesn't change is that the cardiac arrest you're responding to is a... I don't want to use the word stressful or exciting, but it certainly activates the amygdala and gets people wired.
Yes, it does. So cardiac arrest is like, you know, some people think it's our bread and butter. It's something we put out there as part of our identity, is our ability to go and care for patients having cardiac arrest outside of a hospital.
Ask me really quickly how many I've been to in the last 12 months. That's a better question than when's the last one I went to.
All right. Hey, Sonny.
Yes.
How many cardiac arrests have you been to in the last 12 months?
I'm actually really happy you asked me that, Nick, because I've been to two. But if I can actually expand on that, I'm going to say one was workable.
Okay.
That's in 12 months.
Wow. 50-50. And that probably reflects what we see in the data. And we'll get to that in a second. So cardiac arrest seems like the bread and butter of what paramedics do. Part of our identity is the ability to go out into people's homes and try and have a good outcome. But as we know, as the data tells us, a lot of the time the outcome isn't so positive. So I remember when I was back at uni, Sonny, pretty much every cardiac arrest I did within our training, you turn up, you commence resuscitation, and you get ROSC.
Deliver a couple shocks. A
few shocks, a bit of adrenaline. Super glad to get away, get some ROSC. Awesome.
Get a ROSC, high-five each other.
Do you think this is a true representation of what happens out in the real world?
No, not at all. Not at all. Which, I mean, that's a whole different discussion too, in how we're preparing paramedics and simulating things and how we're even maintaining our own skill sets.
Mm.
But no, that is not a true representation. Look, things have obviously developed a long way since you and I were in that space, and there's a lot more managing of recognition of life extinct, or whatever people call it these days, as well as ROSC, and even the, you know, recognize the unworkable cardiac arrests. You know, I think it was a year after I qualified, Nick, I actually, I was that person who managed the airway of a patient who we since found out had rigor mortis. So it's that recognition of when we should intervene and when certainly it's going to be futile and not. One of the things that came up in that discussion I heard in my workplace, though, was a statement that was actually used by some paramedics who attended a cardiac arrest that one of my non-clinical colleagues actually went to, and she was actually mortally offended by it. And it was interesting, again, being a fly on the wall and hearing this statement, because it was a paramedic actually appropriately recognizing that nothing could be done for their family member, and they used a statement, the patient is incompatible with life. Have you heard that before?
Yeah.
Now, it's a fairly common term for paramedics to use because it, I mean, it spells out exactly what we need to know about the case, but it's not really the language or the terminology that you would expect to find out in the public space, I guess.
No. And you're right, a lot of the cases, or probably the majority of the cases we go to, are not patients that are suitable for resuscitation. And so realistically, part of it, how we prepare ourselves to attend a cardiac arrest needs to be a proportion of that. More than 50% of our focus needs to be on how we look after the patients who are deceased, who are dead, who have died, whatever terminology you want to use, and how we care for the family. Because really, realistically, when we attend those scenes, yes, we're caring for the patient who has died, but also we need to care for the bystanders and the family that are left on scene. So part of our responsibility as paramedics is to care for that family. We're not doing any specific interventions for them, like the clinical stuff, as we focus a lot on sometimes, but it's all about all that communication, empathy, and helping that person through that difficult time. So if we look at the data, I'm going to use the Queensland Ambulance Service data. They do a cardiac arrest report every 12 months based on what's happened in the last 12 months in the state of Queensland. For those overseas listeners, Queensland's, I think it's the second or third largest ambulance service in the world, and we cover thousands of kilometres worth of land or area from metropolitan, rural, and quite remote places. So if we look at the data, about 60% of the cardiac arrests we attend, we do not resuscitate. Does that surprise you?
It does. It certainly does, because those are not the stories you hear from people. They are certainly not often the stories that are shared for educational purposes. But, I mean, if we're going if this is one service and they're going to 60% of the cases that can't be resuscitated, it's fair to assume that that's going to be a likely outcome for many of the services.
And it will change. It'll change slightly. Like, I know, like, places like London, they have a lot more witness cardiac arrests because you have a large transient population coming into the city, coming into holiday, go to work, that kind of thing. So they have larger amounts of witness cardiac arrests during the daytime under the Friday. And whereas, say, in the state of Queensland, 80% of cardiac arrests occur in people's homes.
If 60% of these cases, though, are not workable, and we're spending most of our time rehearsing the workable arrest, we're actually not rehearsing the 60% of these presentations.
Correct.
That's a problem.
It is a problem. So how do we get better? We need to make sure if we are focusing on cardiac arrest as part of our training, we look at all the circumstances. So focusing on the patients that we do resuscitate, as well as focusing on how we look after the patients and their families or the ones that we don't. Okay.
And so we're not going to be talking about cardiac arrest in terms of the pathophysiology and what's going on inside the body. We're going to be talking about, I guess, the management of such and how to approach.
Correct.
As a way of improving our practice.
Yeah, and how do we do it in the context of the outer hospital environment where paramedics generally practice? So let's say we turn up. Let's get a hypothetical case study. We turn up, we've called to a 60-year-old female who's collapsed at home. It's a witness to collapse, and they've been to bystander CPR. We've managed to respond in a timely manner. It's been, let's call it 9 minutes, because that is the average response time in Queensland at the moment. Respond in 9 minutes, and we find a patient in a back bedroom of a low-set house, and there's a man there who identifies himself as a husband who's performing some chest compressions. What do you
think? Well, are these adequate compressions? Because I've been to plenty of people before who are attempting.
Here's a question. How do you determine adequate CPR?
Look, the only things I often look for when I'm approaching there is it going to be deep enough, and is it going to be an appropriate rate? And the reason why I say an appropriate rate is because I have seen far too slow people who've done the CPR training 20 years ago, and I've also seen far too fast where they're excited, they're activated, they're not really thinking clearly. So Those are the two things I'm looking for. Is there anything you're looking for that I've missed?
Pretty much the same. And I think you also have to take it with a grain of salt that, you know, if someone's been doing bystander CPR for a prolonged period of time, just because it's taken 10 minutes for us to get there or 12 minutes for us to get there, and when we turn up, it's ineffective, let's not assume that they've had 12 minutes of ineffective CPR. Most lay people haven't done CPR before. So they might do some appropriate CPR for 6, 7, 8 minutes and maybe get a bit fatigued at the end or emotional or upset because of the situation that they find themselves in. So I think it's sometimes difficult to assume that they've had ineffective CPR for that entire period, and maybe don't let that influence your decision-making around whether or not to attempt resuscitation. Because there are some thoughts around, you know, if it's been greater than 10 minutes without effective CPR, then maybe this isn't a patient that is viable for resuscitation. But in the context of that...
However, some may be. I mean, everyone's built differently.
That's, you know, it.
There's been plenty of patients that no one's been working on for a while, and when someone starts, they actually find a sort of shockable rhythm. So that's a fair point, Nick.
Yeah.
Don't let those assumptions creep in.
And, you know, if in doubt, it's reasonable to start CPR. Okay, it's a reasonable start. You can always start, get some information, and then make a decision about whether or not you think it's appropriate to continue to resuscitate the patient. So let's say you've turned up, you introduced yourself to this gentleman who said she was fine, she was cooking, and she's collapsed. Okay. What's your first thoughts or actions?
It's just that shift in algorithm. I mean, I've got to keep myself safe, but I'm going to look for a response for her. Now, if he is conducting compressions often, I mean, that's quite uncomfortable and painful. So if no one's actually responding to those compressions, it's fair to say they're not responding at all.
Yeah.
I will certainly get in there myself and just see if there's any response to some kind of stimuli.
Yeah.
But if there's not, it's just that pulse check. And I know that's a controversial thing sometimes, because a pulse check can be quite difficult for people to conduct appropriately, especially when stress is happening. But it is one of the key things that we need to understand. Do they have a pulse or do they not have a pulse? Now, if they do, then my algorithm just shifts to some basic airway management, trying to figure out what's going on. And if they don't, well, it's straight into compressions, because we know the chain of survival needs blood pumping to those vital organs, and early defib if it's shockable.
Yeah. So let's say you're by yourself, Sonny. Do you think there's a case for getting to coach that bystander through some better quality CPR while you put the pads on?
Look, half my career has actually been working as a solo officer by myself. What I've had to learn to do is essentially deputize willing people. Now, I say willing people because rather than asking people what qualifications they have in terms of first aid, I learned quickly that one of the better questions to ask people is, are you able to assist?
Yeah.
Are you willing to assist? Because even someone who doesn't have a first aid qualification is still potentially going to be an asset to you if they are willing to assist. And when we break down what's needed in a cardiac arrest, you know, we could teach just about anybody how to do adequate compressions. So for me as a solo officer, I certainly learned to deputize people quickly. And it's a really good discussion to have, Nick, because I think there's a lot of growing areas in paramedicine where people are working by themselves.
Yeah, 100%. Which sounds like a good podcast topic we should talk about sometime.
I mean, look, even sometimes when you're working with someone, you might be working with a brand new student, a brand new graduate, someone who's just moved into the area and are new to the service. And sometimes it is similar to working by yourself, and you do need to keep those the communication as clear, concise, and simple as possible for them to be an asset. But I think a lot of those initial stages of cardiac arrest management come down to just good communication.
Yep, 100%. So, Steve, you think back, you reflect on all the cardiac arrests you've been to over your career. How often did you find the patient in a large open space with 360-degree access with good lighting? Like almost like a classroom, like, you know how a classroom looks?
Not often, no.
No. So what do you normally, like, you think about, like, in our context of patients, 80% of patients have a cardiac arrest in their own home. Generally, where do you find them?
I found a significant number actually in bed.
Yeah.
Inadequate compressions being performed because of the soft nature of the mattress they're on, and we need to remove them from that area. A good chunk in the bathroom or the toilet area, which creates logistical issues. And then also a large part of them actually doing yard work. Now, the yard work ones have actually been quite inviting because there is workable space.
Mm.
But no, a large chunk of those have certainly been spaces that not built for us to move around.
So Nick, in your career, you're often backing people up to these things. What have you found? Are people creating space for you, or is this one of the first things you need to actually manage?
I think it depends. I think it depends on the stage of the arrest you walk into. I think sometimes people get tunnel visioned on resuscitating the patient in the environment that they're in, and that's fine. And sometimes they've recognised that the space that they're in isn't ideal and they need to move to a better place.
Well, can I challenge what we're discussing here really quickly? Because the chain of survival is quite simple, right? I mean, it's early access to the person and early recognition. It's early CPR, early defib, and then early ALS care.
Yep.
Where in there does it say create space to work on the patient?
Well, it doesn't.
Or is this in the early access?
It could be. And I think that's an anecdotal thing I think you get from doing a number of these in people's homes and these places is if you've ever tried to resuscitate someone in a cramped space, it just doesn't work. It's really, really difficult. And you might be able to delegate improving the space out to someone. So something I like to do is whenever you walk into someone's house, first thing you should be doing is scanning the space to identify an area that you could move this patient to if where they were wasn't an ideal space. So really you got two options. You can either move the patient to a better place or make the place that the patient's in better. Okay, so let's say they're in a back bedroom. You might be able to take the queen bed or the bed and flip it on its side and create a bit more space there. Or you may not be able to do that, so you decide to take the patient and take them down a hallway into a lounge room. And sometimes you can't make the space better. Sometimes you're just in a cramped position because there's no better place to go to, or the patient's too big, or it's too far away, and you just have to work with what you have. And that's challenging. But I can tell you from experience that if you can make it better, do so, because it'll make your resuscitation go a lot more smoother.
Even while we're speaking about how to make your resuscitation go smoother, we're talking about creating space for the patient, the person. A lot of this, I guess, people are probably visualizing an adult patient, you know, moving a heavy adult patient into an area where they can assist. And I think it was really remiss of us not even to suggest pediatrics sometimes in this context too, because moving a pediatric patient in cardiac arrest into an area where you can work on sometimes involves literally picking up that small child and placing them on a coffee table.
Correct.
Where you've got a good heart surface to work on, everyone can kneel around that patient too. So it's taking this in the context of that situation.
Yep.
Nick, we've been talking about space, creating space around a person to actually allow us a better, essentially work environment to assist these people in cardiac arrest.
Yeah.
From your experience, have you got any other like helpful tips and tricks that can help the listener manage a cardiac arrest just that little bit better, or anything that you've learned through your career that can just improve these experiences for people?
Yeah, I think there's three things I'll bring up. The firstly is around airway management. We've got these really great, in Queensland, we've introduced iGels, which is a new supraglottic airway. It doesn't require any air to be placed into the device to inflate it. It's made out of gel, so it doesn't have an area that needs to be inflated. They're great. They're very quick to place, and we're starting to place them as a primary airway in cardiac arrest. Something that I've noticed anecdotally is sometimes these airways are getting caught on the tongue and the operator is struggling to insert the airway because they can't transition it past the tongue. So a way in which you can overcome that, A, lube's a great thing, but B, if you grab your non-dominant hand and place it behind the occiput of the patient and extend their head back, the mouth will naturally want to open wider. And sometimes when you do this, it will create a larger space for you to be able to advance that eye gel past the tongue. Now, once you get past the tongue, it's very it'll seat quite nicely down in front of the larynx. Secondly, access is access. You don't need to get large bore access on these patients early, especially like if you wanted to get access to give, say, like an antiarrhythmic medication like amiodarone. The sooner they get this, the better, and the greater the chance they are going to have, in combination of some other really good core principles of getting out of that that rhythm and into a perfusing rhythm. So, you know, if they've got poor vasculature, If it's difficult to see things, even just something like a little 22 gauge in the back of the hand, an appropriate place to start. Start there, and you can always escalate your access as the cardiac arrest progresses. And finally, when we go to shock a patient, and we naturally want to go hands off, everyone away from the patient, so we can analyze the rhythm and shock the patient safely. Now, when we do this, we pause compressions. What we're doing is we're reducing the amount of flow back to the heart. Because remember, when we do compressions, we're also getting blood back into that coronary vasculature, that supply blood to the myocardium, right? So that's why we want to limit the time off hands off chest as much as possible. So one way we can do this, and that's changing the way in which we do it, is rather than going hands off the chest completely and having that 5-10 second pause, is continue to do compressions, create a charge on the monitor. When the charge is ready, it get the person doing CPR to accentuate the upstroke, bring the hands off the chest, view the monitor, confirm whether or not it needs to be shocked, shock the patient, and then they bring their arms back down and continue compressions. And you'll probably save quite a few seconds off the chest when you do this. It's difficult, you've got to practice it, but it can really reduce that hands off chest time that's so important with improving outcomes in these patients.
There will be some people out there that say it increases the risk of an injury to the paramedics.
Mm.
What's your view on that?
Well, like anything, it needs to be practiced. It's not something you can just theoretically think about now and then do it really well down the line. And like anything, if we don't practice doing it properly, there's always inherent risks associated. It's like manual tasking, right? Like if we don't practice manual tasking properly, the risk we're going to injure ourselves. If we don't practice this properly, there's a risk that we could injure ourselves. So it's really important that we do go and practice these things. I've seen it done really well and it works really well. I don't think it necessarily increases your risk of injury unless you don't do it effectively. We'll probably make a video about this and show you exactly what we mean. So check out the website in the next few weeks to months and you might see something there. What do you think, Steve?
The three really, really valuable points that you've raised there, Nick, and I think, any of the listeners out there, they might either be doing it or you're certainly giving them some food for thought. But there's also a key theme to these improvements, these interventions that I keep hearing, and it was even at the very beginning of this podcast when we were talking about the non-clinical aspects of it, but it's rehearsal.
Mm.
Rehearsal, rehearsal, rehearsal. Look, there's a lot of paramedic shifts out there these days are so busy, people just don't get a chance to practice. But we need to be honest with ourselves and clear about this. Rehearsing things is where you develop.
Yep.
It's where you improve. And so although we might be busy out on the job doing a lot of things, there's going to be a lot of instances that we're just not exposed to. And cardiac arrest is one of those. And so we need to find the time to rehearse these things, not just the clinical aspects of what we're doing here, but also the non-clinical aspects of it. So I think for me, the key take home here, the recurring theme that we keep coming back to is just rehearsing this situation.
So Steve, let's say we do this cardiac arrest. We've done all our clinical interventions and it looks like we're not going to get a ROSC on this patient. And statistically, of the patients we do resuscitate, if we look across all our witnessed versus unwitnessed versus shockable, non-shockable rhythm, a patient's more likely to die than to achieve ROSC and have a favorable outcome. That's just what the data says. So as paramedics, we need to be capable of being able to deal with that situation. So, Steve, what advice would you give for young clinicians or younger or new clinicians about how they can approach that part of the care for this patient and their families?
You've got to put the human back into this now. I mean, a lot of what we do is got to disassociate ourselves from what's actually happening so that we can influence and improve outcomes for people, but sometimes it just doesn't happen.
Mm.
And we need to be prepared for that. We need to be prepared and understand our own humanistic responses to these, as well as try and understand what that family is going through. Put yourself in their shoes. And, it's why I say we've got to put the human back into it. Again, rehearsing what you're going to say is obviously going to assist, because then hopefully you'll avoid things like the patient is incompatible with life.
Yeah.
We've done all we can. It's probably not going to get the desired response from that family. People don't understand this terminology. So you need to be prepared for the patients that that won't recover, for the ones that will be futile, and we need to make sure that we get the language around them. So, I mean, look, for me personally, through my career, if I have been at cardiac arrest, that, you know, we've literally explored every single avenue we can. We've expired every single intervention we can, and it's just not having the desired outcome. It's preparing the team that I'm working with first. And so it's making sure that everyone on the team acknowledges that we're all of the same opinion, that this unfortunate case is not going to have a favorable outcome, and we need to prepare for that. Once we've actually communicated with each other and we're all on the same page, it's never a pleasant thing to go and advise the family that things aren't going to work well. And I've seen this, you know, you and I have talked in the past about mentoring and tormentoring in paramedicine. There's a big difference. And, you know, I've seen a lot of people throw the inexperienced clinician to the wolves, especially in this situation where they say, well, the only way to get experience is go get experience. Okay, so go do it. But I don't believe that's actually appropriate for the family. I don't believe it's appropriate for the novice clinician either. I think that the way you get experience is witnessing people and watching people and learning how to do it. So if there's a place to do it, I will often take the responsibility myself. I will be the one to go and communicate with the family. And if there is a novice clinician who isn't necessarily engaged in the final stages of care, come with me. Come with me, and I'll deliver the news to the patient. And look, every situation is different. Every family is different. Every person is different. So, you know, there's no one way of doing this appropriately, but certainly the way that I've got the best response from people is just coming up to them before we stop. So there's still another cycle occurring, but we know that's probably going to be another cycle. And explaining to them, you've been here, you've witnessed us, We've explored every avenue we can. We've implemented every single intervention we can. And unfortunately, today, whoever the patient is just not responding to this. So you need to now prepare yourself to say goodbye. It just gives them that little bit of support. And so they can start understanding, hey, I'm going to have to come and say goodbye. And it is incredibly confronting. I've never enjoyed it. Like I said, every situation is different. But from my experience, that's just what's worked the most positively for me through my career. And having a student, having a graduate, having a novice paramedic next to me to witness that. Sometimes I've had some good feedback and how I can manage it better. Sometimes they have learned a lot from watching me. It's always a learning process.
Yeah, you're right. There's no one way to do it. I'm a bit more, you can use different words, direct, honest. I like to, well, not like, like's the wrong word. I approach it in a similar fashion. I like to continue the resuscitation ongoing. So you can go and you can have the conversation on your own terms. You're not stopping the resuscitation. The family are viewing that, and then they're saying, what are you doing? Why are you stopping? What's going on? And then you're kind of caught up and you're behind the eight ball in a sense. Like, you want to continue the resuscitation and go and have the conversation on your terms. And having that conversation, I'm very similar in what you do, Steve, but I like to use the word died, or they're going to die, like in a future tense process, just so it's clear, everyone, most people understand death, died, dead. Dead's a bit, I don't love dead. I think died, I don't know why, it just seems what I've used over the years. Passed away, I think sometimes can get a bit misunderstood sometimes in certain cultures. Some people don't appreciate it or understand it, and that's okay. So I use that they're going to die, and then give them an opportunity to process that. They'll have their response, and that can be varied responses, and that's okay. But also give them an opportunity to come and be with a patient when we stop. And I reckon 99% of family members have taken me up on that offer to be allowed to come and be with a patient when they die. And for them, it's their way of being there to support that person in this this poignant point in their life. And maybe it does help them to heal down the track. There is some literature out there to say that family members who do witness cardiac arrests and resuscitations do get less post-traumatic stress as a result, and maybe being there when we stop resuscitation is part of that. I don't know.
It's a challenging thing, hey, and it's certainly something that educationally it's a difficult thing to even prepare people for, because It is so dynamic. Mm. Every single situation is different. And there's certainly, I mean, there's two colleagues here, there's two friends, and both of us deliver it in a different way. But unfortunately, the message is going to be the same. But today's another day.
Yeah.
I mean, it's deep stuff, but I think these conversations sometimes they need to be had. And hopefully, you know, this podcast, it's got some experiential pearls of wisdom there. You know, the three things you discussed earlier and how they can possibly improve their cardiac arrest management. But this is a big part of it. I mean, 60% of the cases in this one area alone, this is what's going to happen.
Yep, that's it. Well, I think that's all we have time for, Steve. Thanks for coming on again today.
Not a problem. There's actually an article published a couple of months ago on the Shift Extension magazine. It was about patients being in attendance to cardiac arrest. And I think that might actually be a really good discussion to have later on, mate.
I'll put the link in the show notes. If people want to find more articles, where do they head to?
Shiftsextension.org. And there they'll find all the information they need from the podcast, the magazine, to research projects. And we're going to be launching a few seminars this year.
Awesome. Well, thanks for listening. But until next time, see you later.